anger and shame in soccer-mad Brazil. Today, Wednesday, July 9th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Host Brazil didn't just lose to Germany in the World Cup. It got crushed, 7-1. But don't dare suggest Brazil should just get over it, that the country's beloved futebol is only a game.
If you're in Brazil, if you're a Brazilian, you will never see the sentence, that's only a game. To be Brazilian, it's to know about football.
Meanwhile, Germans are left almost speechless by their win.
It was unbelievable. We couldn't believe what we were seeing there.
Also, life near the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip amid rocket fire and airstrikes.
Sometimes you just hear an explosion and realize what it is and run for your safe room.
All that's just ahead. Plus, you'll never guess what topped the classical music charts.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned in to The World. Brazil's singer-songwriter Caetano Veloso has a new CD out, and it couldn't be more timely.
Estou triste, tão triste.
That song, Estou Triste, could be Brazil's national anthem today. I'm sad is how that translates. I didn't believe it when I saw the 7-1 German defeat of the legendary Brazilians yesterday, but it was hard to deny the TV picture. One German ball going in the goal after another. Brazilian defender David Luiz was in tears as he walked off the field.
O Brasil inteiro feliz, pelo menos por causa do futebol.
He and his team had hoped to bring some happiness to Brazilians. Instead, the opposite. The team, the Seleção, made their country cry.
It's not the happiest day of my life.
I understand. That's Bruno de Almeida, the senior editor for soccer for Globo Esporte. What is the mood there today, Bruno?
Well, I went this morning to a newspaper stand, and I heard a couple of old men talking. And I think what they said defines what most of the Brazilians are thinking now. The old man said, it's like I lost a beloved relative. It's a very sad day. It's a mix of anger, shame. It's a very sad day.
I understand the shame, but what is the anger about? Is it anger at the players for not doing well, or is it anger at just the whole World Cup and Brazil and everything that's been invested in it?
Well, it's about the whole World Cup, you know, all the infrastructure that was promised and not delivered. It's also about the hope that we had in the national team, about the history of the yellow shirt. So I think the anger is not exclusive about the football. It's also about everything that's happening here in Brazil.
Has there ever been a loss as symbolically huge as this one? Probably not for Brazil, but ever?
No. Our biggest loss in Brazil that we always like to remember is the Maracanazo of 1950, the first World Cup that we lost against Uruguay, a 2-1 defeat that nobody expected when 200,000 people were at Maracanã waiting for the biggest party of all time, and then they have the huge silence of people leaving the stadium. And we had something really, really similar yesterday.
But it is a game. In the end, it's only a game. When do you think Brazil will be able to just kind of shrug and say that?
Marco, well, if you're in Brazil, if you're a Brazilian, you will never say the sentence, that's only a game. That actually, football, it's part of Brazilian culture. To be Brazilian, it's to know about football. It's to feel football and to follow it, even if you don't like football. Football, it's present in our language. You know, when you want to say something is good, you say, oh, that's a soccer good. It's an expression that we say in Portuguese. You know, it's not only a game for Brazil. It's something that we're really proud about. That's not many things that we're proud about in Brazil. So that's why that's so important.
As you said, that yellow jersey, the Brazilian jersey, it pretty much says everything. It's an incredibly strong brand. We're hearing here that the fallout from this loss could have political implications, even for President Dilma Rousseff. Is that possible?
Yes.
Explain that.
As football is so inside Brazilian culture, everything that happens in football has a direct influence of people's lives, including political life. I don't think that protests and riots are going to happen during the World Cup. But after the World Cup, it's going to be a hard time for all politicians in general. When people are unhappy, they tend to maximize their feelings towards the common enemy. And the common enemy at this time, the whole politic world in Brazil, because we had a very expensive World Cup and lots of infrastructure things we didn't deliver. They promised big airports, big roads, and well, not all were delivered. So I think that we can have some protests after the World Cup.
Well, Bruno, I usually take the it's only a game kind of line on these occasions, but I do wish you and all Brazilians condolences today.
Well, I have to agree. It's only a game. You're right about that. But it's difficult to say that in a culture where the football is so close to our hearts.
Bruno de Almeida, senior editor for soccer or football for Global Esporte in Sao Paulo. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
It wasn't just fans in Brazil who were crushed by yesterday's defeat.
When you see something like Brazilian soccer, which was the most positive, wonderful way of playing the game, you know, I just felt heartbroken at the demise of something that was once so wonderful.
Franklin Foer wrote the book How Soccer Explains the World.
This was such a humiliation. It was such an unexpected defeat for the Brazilian public that there's a pretty strong case that a country's performance in the World Cup affects the general mood, and especially in a country like Brazil, where the game is so intimately tied to people's sense of self-worth and the state of the country.
As for, you know, this being a country that already had a lot of critics of the Cup before it started and the money that was spent on the World Cup, is this going to kind of seriously continue polarizing the country?
I think it will. There are a couple of reasons, because it does reflect on some broader tides in Brazilian society. The first is that Brazil has acquired a massive middle class over the course of the last decade. And that strong middle class now has very middle class concerns about the way that their government spent money. And I was in Brazil, and I went to some of the stadiums during the World Cup, and I was pretty amazed at the marble staircases that I saw in the Sao Paulo Stadium and the extent to which the government made economically irrational investments that could only be explained by some of the underlying corruption in the Brazilian system. And I think that corruption, in fact, helps explain the poor performance of Brazil on the soccer pitch, that the Brazilian game, much more broadly, is afflicted by corruption. It's run by a bunch of oligarchs who pad their own pockets and sell players to European clubs in order to make a profit.
Yeah. These men you're talking about, they are part of the Brazilian Soccer Federation?
It's not just the Brazilian Soccer Federation. It trickles down throughout the entire ecosystem of the sport. So you have club owners who are corrupt, agents who are corrupt, journalists even who are complicit in the corruption, and politicians who countenance the entire system. And over time, it's resulted in some very bad investments that the country has made. And those bad investments have hindered its economic growth when you look at corruption's effect on society more grandly. And it's also hindered the country's soccer growth because youth and talent aren't nurtured in the proper way that they should.
Given the protests last year before the World Cup and after the Confederations Cup in Brazil, do you think this ended up being just a really high-stakes risk for Brazil putting on the World Cup?
The country's actually performed fairly well during this World Cup. People predicted that it wasn't logistically up to the task, that its airports and its roads and its stadiums would be built in such shoddy way that they would embarrass themselves in front of the entire world. But I do think for the Brazilian elite, which was so determined to put on this big show for the world, I do think that they will be punished in some sort of way for spending such wild sums of money on a spectacle that was not accompanied in the end by a Brazilian triumph.
But what about other losses? I mean, give us some examples from history of past defeats for countries and the consequences for them where, you know, a soccer defeat gets translated into a political or economic defeat.
Well, it's interesting in the way in which successes and victories end up reflecting a lot of the caricatures that we have about a country's national character. So you take a country like Germany. In 2000, Germany failed to qualify for the European Championships, and they attacked the problem by remaking their entire style of play. And that was exactly what was on display yesterday when they thrashed Brazil. And in England, Harold Wilson was said to have maintained power in 1966 after his country won the World Cup that it hosted there. And then when the country failed to do well at the 1970 World Cup, he lost his hold on power. In Brazil, when Brazil lost the finals of the 1998 World Cup, there was a backlash against globalization that fell because the country was so desperate to look for a scapegoat for its defeat.
I don't know who you were rooting for, who you're still rooting for, but how deeply did this Brazil defeat affect you?
I have many relatives who live in Brazil, and I'd grown up intoxicated with the mythology and magic.
The yellow jersey.
The canary yellow jersey. And I called my cousins in the middle of the match when it was incredibly clear where it was heading. And it just broke my heart.
Franklin Foer, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Great to speak with you.
Pleasure.
So, broken hearts in Brazil. But what about in Germany? We reached Sebastian Christ in Berlin, where he watched the match.
I was meeting with some friends, and we were thinking about going outside, watching it in a fan area with a big screen where the transmission was shown to many, many people on the streets. But then we decided to watch the match in the living room of a friend because we really didn't know how this whole thing would end. So we decided to go to this living room there, and we were sitting there, and after 10 minutes, I think, or something like that, the first goal was scored by Müller, and that was the time when I was kind of happy. And then the second goal was scored by Klose, and I was even happier, and after the third goal, I couldn't believe what I see.
And what did you start to think once you get to number 4 and 5? It's just, I mean, we've never really seen this kind of thing before in a semifinal, have we?
Yes, of course. And I stopped thinking, honestly, because it was unbelievable. We couldn't believe what we were seeing there. We have expected, let's say, a 2-1 or something like that. It's pretty normal, and I think for a half final, it's okay. But a 7-1 against Brazil, yeah, it's a result like a World Cup 1954.
Well, Brazil was clearly not playing up to par yesterday. Did that make the win, the victory for Germany, a little like kind of stealing candy from a baby?
Yeah, it was really nasty to see all these fans there from Brazil when we were watching them in TV, and they were crying, and it was really nasty. I felt a bit guilty, to be honest.
We all know Germany has a fantastic soccer team. That's a pretty standard thing for Germany. What does this victory mean, though, for the whole country?
We are still searching for words to explain that. The biggest tabloid here in Germany, they had this page 1 today, and they were just printing a huge photo of Müller, our striker, the German team, and they were printing only 2 words, and these words were without birds, yeah? So they had no headline. They had really no headline for this whole match because they had no really words that were fitting for this whole thing that happened yesterday. I think many people here in Germany are today thinking about how this could happen yesterday, and they still can't believe it. But I think now most of the German people here, they believe that the German team will win the title, of course. Yeah. That is the mood here.
For the next game, for the final, do you enter cautiously or you just keep up the confidence?
Yes, of course. I'm really confident that we will win the Cup this year. And at the moment, I think Germany proved with a half final that they are the strongest team in the tournament and the whole competition.
Sebastian Christ in Berlin, very happy for you and your winning Germans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And one more World Cup note. One thing we're missing this week in all the coverage, the live tweets from Isidoro, our World Cup win-picking ocelot. Izzy had been predicting the USA matches until that team lost to Belgium last week. But this Friday, Izzy is back with his pick for the winner of Sunday's World Cup final. We'll announce Izzy's prediction on Friday's show. In the meantime, follow Izzy on Twitter. Check him out at IzzyPicks. That's IzzyPicks. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Imagine being on your balcony and watching bombs falling all around you. That's what you're about to hear. A man in the Gaza Strip. And in a moment, an Israeli woman sheltering in a kibbutz. We're not going to focus on the Israeli Defense Forces and their strikes in Gaza, and we're not going to focus on Hamas rockets. We're just going to meet two people on either side of this crisis, both trying to live their lives. We start with Amjad Shawa.
I'm living in the middle of the Gaza city, which is now under intensive airstrikes from different areas, from the fighters and from helicopters. Right now I'm in the balcony and with my family for sure, but I left my family in order to talk with you. They are scared and, you know, the children, every minute we have an airstrike, so they are very scared about what's happening. And
how many children are there in your house?
I have four children, two boys, two girls.
Right.
The youngest is the 4 years old, so he's very scared.
How are they dealing with the shock of these bombs?
You know, each airstrike, they're screaming and they're coming to us, to me and their mom, in order to, they want to be hided or to be saved. And, you know, they want to say about the situation here. We are following up the news and now they are targeting houses with families. Today, about four or five families, into your family, were killed. The father, mother and children were killed. So the situation really catastrophic. Only I can see from my balcony the ambulance car, which only they are moving from area to area in order to get the injuries or the bodies of the people who are under the rubble of the houses which were destroyed.
And you're in the center of Gaza City. I assume that you're probably pretty close to where some of these rockets are falling.
Yeah, well, just in the last 30 minutes, I can say that there was from 10 to 15 airstrikes, and only in the Gaza City.
Right. Well, this has obviously happened before. The people in the Gaza Strip know this kind of episode quite well, sadly. We spoke with actually a reporter yesterday who told us about these warnings that Israel sends to targets or houses like where you live in Gaza, letting them know that a rocket attack is imminent. Have you received any warnings like this?
No, we didn't receive. And all of that, I don't know how I heard about receiving the warning by sending a rocket, small rocket to the house, and the people have seconds to leave the home. How you can warn a family? You know, we have big families in Gaza. 50, 60 people are living in the same house. All people are living, so just to give them seconds or a few minutes in order to leave the house. And we are overpopulated area. We are 1.89 million Palestinians who are living only in 360 kilometers. So how you can escape, how you can be safe in such conditions. At the same time, I have to mention that Gaza under siege, under tight blockade for the seventh year, suffering from shortage of everything.
Amjad, I mean, you're talking about some pretty intense stuff here, and I'm just wondering how you explain all this to the children in your house who don't have an understanding of the crazy politics that drives this stuff.
Believe me, it's very difficult. It's very, very, very difficult time for the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. And we hope that an international community, mainly the American, can understand well. There is another airstrike right now.
Amjad, so, you just said that there was a rocket attack taking place. How were you able to know that it was incoming?
As I told you, I'm from the balcony.
I see.
I can see the light of the rocket, and in the same time, I can hear the rocket itself.
Amjad Shawa, who lives in Gaza City, thank you for your time. Stay safe, please.
Thank you. Thank you.
By the way, we checked in with Amjad and his family after that conversation, and they are fine. Here's a view now from the Israeli side. Adele Raymer lives in a kibbutz in Nirim, near the border with Gaza. She's an American by birth. Now, her life on the kibbutz is arguably more comfortable than life in Gaza City on a good day. Still, rockets landing near the kibbutz are Adele's reality now. Her daughter had planned to get married there on the 4th of July, but she and her fiancé had to change plans pretty quickly.
They realized that they cannot responsibly bring 300 guests to our kibbutz. We have a pool. There's about 400 residents on this kibbutz, and the pool serves the community. And we do have like a little safe area there for people to run to if there is an alert while they're swimming. But it's certainly not large enough to hold 300 people at once. So we had to find a different venue. We got lots and lots of different communities saying that they could have the wedding in their pool or on their lawn or in their gardens. And it was really very heartwarming. In times of stress like we are now, people really, really come through for each other.
So your big concern was that your daughter's wedding party would come under attack. I mean,
that's right.
You're close to the border. How many seconds do you have to make it to a shelter before a rocket explodes?
We have about 10 seconds. They say 15, but it's not. It's more like 10. And sometimes it's even less. The other day, four rockets fell in the kibbutz perimeter. You never really know. And sometimes you just hear an explosion and realize what it is and run for your safe room.
You're in your safe room right now. You're doing this interview from your safe room.
The television is here broadcasting all day specially. And every few minutes, in fact, you see a notification of where there are rockets falling. And rockets often fall in the region of Eshkol because it hugs the Gaza Strip. So where, you know, any place in the Gaza Strip, they can fire these short-range mortars or rockets and get to us very easily.
Yeah, I gather a rocket landed in your friend's garden this week.
The rocket hit a tree and it exploded, and I don't even want to think what could have happened.
Adele, describe the safe room where you're talking to us from. Yeah.
It's reinforced cement because we're so close to the border. The government built safe rooms onto our houses. It's the size of a small bedroom. I have a bed in it, two little night tables, and I've got a TV in here. I can bring my computer in here when I have to work.
How does all this make you feel?
Deja vu.
Yeah, because this has happened many times.
This happened in 2012, yeah. When it happened in 2009, and I had just lost my husband a month before, so I took my dogs and I left for about a week.
Why have you stayed this time?
Because this is my home, and you know what? Half of Israel is in rocket range now, if not more. It's also complicated because I do have two dogs, and you can't just go just any place with animals. You know, not every hotel is willing to take you.
When the rockets are coming in from Gaza, does it ever kind of cross your mind how the Israeli rockets might be received on the other end and what the Palestinians in Gaza are going through?
All the time. I think about it all the time. They don't have safe rooms. The situation there is dire, and I really, my heart goes out to them.
Do you ever find yourself wondering how all this is going to end? I mean, not just this episode, but all of them.
Well, I'm hoping that at some point both sides will find the way to sit down and talk and listen on both sides. I do truly believe that if possibly anything good comes of this military action, it will be that the Hamas will be ready to sit down and say, okay, you know what? Maybe you won't be such bad neighbors after all. Let's sit down and talk.
Adele, thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much for caring.
Adele Raymer lives near Israel's border with Gaza, and we also spoke there with Amjad Shawa in Gaza City. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Some call him Sasquatch, some call him the Yeti, but this scientist calls him science fiction.
Hundreds of 8-foot tall mammals running around North America without one single shred of evidence. I find that difficult to believe.
The global search for Bigfoot just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Here's a number to ruminate on, 1,000. That's how many young migrants are said to be pouring over the U.S. border every week. Most are coming from Central America, escaping violence and poverty. Violence and poverty are just words, though. What do they actually mean? For that, you've got to hear the stories of two recent arrivals from Guatemala. The World's Monica Campbell caught up with them. They're now in California.
I meet Luis Figueroa and Mario Kevin Lopez in Berkeley on a street near train tracks. It's where day laborers congregate, hoping to get work. Luis and Mario are new faces here, and younger than most. They're both 17 now, and crossed over from Guatemala recently. They're from the same town, but only met here.
Hola, Luis. ¿Cómo va todo?
Todo bien.
They're in work boots and jeans, ready to do any manual labor they can find. But it's slow today, so there's time to talk about their new lives here and why they each left Guatemala.
No querían porque decían que en el camino se sufre mucho.
Luis says his parents didn't want him to go, but he felt he had no choice. It was either farming and earning barely enough his whole life, or being forced into a gang like so many of his friends. Mario agrees.
Roban, matan, secuestran.
The gangs rob, kidnap, and kill, he says. If he refused to join, it could mean death. The only way out is to leave, he says.
Pues ahí, porque como ya no tenía tanta familia ya.
Mario says both his parents are dead, and nearly all of his relatives have migrated to the United States over the years. So when his uncle in California offered to pay the smuggling fee, $6,000, to bring him here, Mario said yes. He went by bus, paying bribes to everyone from Mexican migration officials and drivers along the way. Near the U.S. border, he met up with smugglers.
Nos llevó a un hotel y ahí nos estuvo encerrados.
He says he was locked in a hotel room with other migrants for 10 days until it was safe to cross. At one point, armed men, kidnappers, burst into the room and demanded ransom.
Y es dinero que tú no puedes pagarlo.
The men said that if you couldn't pay up, they'd kill you, Mario says. His relatives wired another $1,000, but he remembers one boy who couldn't get money wired and tried escaping from a bathroom window. Mario watched as the men grabbed the boy and beat him. Luis's trek was just as rough. It took him days to cross the desert. He suffered extreme thirst and hunger and says he walked by the dead body of someone who didn't make it. And then he was caught in Arizona by immigration officials. The same thing happened to Mario, too. They've both spent time in shelters for minors and were released after a few months. They both have immigration court hearings soon, and they say they'll show up, even if it means deportation. Luis says he'll fight to stay here. He says he wants to stay and work here legit, and he'll try to argue that going back to Guatemala is too dangerous, with one of the world's highest crime rates. But he'll have a hard time making his case under the current law, and he can't afford a lawyer. Mario, on the other hand, sounds resigned. He says if he's deported, he'll go back. But he's also not sure what he'd do in Guatemala. He feels stuck in the middle, between a country that won't let him stay and a country where he sees no future. I asked them what they'd do if they were parents with kids like them. Mario says he wouldn't allow it. The journey is too dangerous. But Luis disagrees. I'd give my son the chance to cross, he says, but he'd have to give it his all. Later, we just talk about daily life here, what they do for fun. There's soccer and music. Mario says he likes the ocean. And he's also teaching himself English. He uses his phone to search for words and phrases. He asks if he can say what he's learned so far.
My name is Mario. I am from Guatemala. I live here in Oakland, California. I am 17 years old.
For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Oakland.
Immigration and the border issue are also the stuff of some gripping TV dramas.
For the past 15 years, the Mexican police, us, the Mexican army, the FBI, everybody has been working that case.
I want to work the dead girls with Marco.
Yeah, that's just a coincidence, people. Another Marco. That's a scene from the first season of The Bridge on FX. Season 2 premieres tonight. The Bridge is set in the Twin Cities of El Paso, Texas, and Juarez in Mexico. It follows two police officers, American Sonia Cross and Mexican Marco Ruiz, in their investigation of a serial killer. It also happens to be bilingual, with scenes in Spanish as well as English. And this is not the only bilingual version of this show. It's based on a Danish-Swedish co-production, also called The Bridge. The two languages in that version were less of an issue. Most Danes can understand Swedish and vice versa, though that show does play on subtle cultural differences between Danes and Swedes. There's also been another bilingual reversioning of the story with more of a cultural and linguistic divide, an English-French drama called, no, not The Channel, but The Tunnel. And as you might expect, the British and the French investigators don't get along too well.
I'm a senior British officer.
I'm the lead investigator. Her head is in France and she's French, so it remains a French investigation.
We'll observe from a distance.
Same story, different languages, you take your pick. All right, let's shift gears now. You've probably heard it called the world's newest country. The world has referred to South Sudan that way. 3 years ago today, South Sudan became an independent nation, and our colleague at the BBC, James Copnell, was there to cover it.
It was a really heady, emotional moment. You had old soldiers crying, people screaming, a moment of real, real joy for the southern Sudanese because they'd fought against Khartoum for decades, two very, very long civil wars in which something like 2.5 million people are estimated to have died. And that means everybody knew someone who had perished in the conflict. Millions of people have been displaced, seen their education dismantled or disrupted. So to finally see freedom, to see the South Sudanese flag rising, not just in Juba, but in towns and villages throughout the new country, was a truly stirring moment for many.
James Copnell stuck with the story and even wrote a book about South Sudan. It's still the world's newest nation, but a lot of that luster has worn off in the last 3 years, as James has seen. Last December, civil war broke out in South Sudan. And now, says James Copnell, there's a looming famine.
It's because of this fighting that over 1 million people have been displaced. And it's because of this fighting that people haven't been able to farm in the way they would have done usually. And people have lost their cows and other animals, sources of livelihood too. So the real fear is that there simply won't be enough food for all these desperate people, and that people who've been displaced beyond the help of the reach of aid agencies or into areas where it's simply too dangerous to go won't get help. Now, South Sudanese have dealt with huge amounts of trauma over decades, really, since well before independence. So the hope is that people are much more resilient than outside agencies and humanitarian groups think they will be. But all the same, the risk of a famine or a huge disaster is clearly there. And worse still, the fighting still continues.
Right. So out of that heady atmosphere 3 years ago of independence, you've got civil war, famine on the horizon. Why has South Sudan struggled so hard?
Well, I think any group of leaders would have faced problems with South Sudan. It was terribly undeveloped after those decades of conflict, had an uneducated population by and large, great challenges. But at the same time, the South Sudanese leaders have failed their people. Now, almost all of them are former rebel leaders, people who are more used to commanding rebel troops than running a country. And there's something which has been called the liberation curse. That is that liberation movements are often badly suited to running the country they then acquire. And you've seen it in other places in Africa too. But in South Sudan, that liberation curse struck very ferociously. And so there was huge amounts of corruption and mismanagement of the economy. Frustration was growing with that. There were clashes with Sudan that hadn't been properly resolved at independence. But there was also a growing leadership battle within the governing party, the SPLM, and tensions between the president, Salva Kiir, and his vice president, Riek Machar, and other people who were also critical of the president. And several people made it clear they wanted to take over. It ended with Riek Machar in rebellion, and the country really devastated now by this new conflict.
James is someone who's invested a lot of time in kind of understanding this new country. I'm curious to know how you felt when you started seeing South Sudan kind of unravel.
Well, very depressed, really. Some of the people who I interviewed for the book, I am no longer in touch with. I simply don't know where they are. I hope they're okay, but I have no way of knowing. Friends of mine lost members of their family, several in some cases, in the fighting. I saw one person who I interviewed several times, and he'd initially been so optimistic. He said, "We've got our country. Mm. I can be happy with that." And the last time I saw this guy, David, he was living in a refugee camp, having fled for his life after attacks on civilians in the capital by the military. And he was in utter despair. And seeing that sort of thing was very difficult for me. So you can imagine what it must be like for the South Sudanese themselves, who had such high hopes on independence.
The BBC's James Copnell, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks.
So do you believe in Bigfoot? You know, Sasquatch or Yeti? Well, get ready to be disappointed believers. A new study out of Oxford University suggests that the mythical creature is just that, a myth. At least for now, the world's Andrea Crossan has more.
Hunting for Bigfoot isn't just a pastime for oddballs hanging out in the woods anymore. It's gone mainstream.
My passion for Bigfoot determined the jobs I took, where I ended up living. I mean, it shaped the course of my life. My role on the team is to do the loudest, furthest carrying Bigfoot calls.
Sounds like a dying cow.
That's a clip from the Animal Planet show, Finding Bigfoot, where a team of scientists and enthusiasts search the world for the mythical primates. But lest you think this is just fodder for reality TV, a new study out of Oxford University has taken the hunt for Bigfoot even further. In 2002, members of the public, scientists, and museum curators were asked to share samples of hair they believed to be from unidentified ape-like creatures. Oxford University genetics professor Brian Sykes led the project.
I've managed to get hold of some samples from famous historical expeditions, such as that led by Sir Edmund Hillary, that have been deposited in museums, some material from Himalayan monasteries, Buddhist monasteries that have been thought of to be yetis, a whole range of materials.
The scientists analyzed 30 hair samples. And their findings?
Bears, cows and horses, even a porcupine, a raccoon, and quite a range of animals, but all known ones.
There were no yetis or Bigfoots, or is that Bigfeet, let alone herds of them.
You have to have a breeding population for these things to have survived as long as they're supposedly been around.
That's New York University anthropology professor Todd Disitel. He's been called the Bigfoot party pooper. Disitel says that the high concentration of hunters and park rangers in North America make it impossible for human-like beasts to remain hidden from cell phone cameras, and that these animals would have to be reproducing.
Hundreds of eight-foot-tall mammals running around North America without one single shred of evidence, I find that difficult to believe.
Disitel does believe that there could be unknown species of primates. He just doesn't believe they're running around Yosemite dodging tourists. But for Professor Sykes, the search continues, and he believes his study opens the door for more scientific investigation into the subject.
There's a good chance if somebody finds a genuine article that there is now a way of proving it to everyone's satisfaction.
It's the most important piece of evidence in Bigfooting history.
Until there is scientific evidence, camera crews will be finding their own evidence. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan.
Footprints are the best hard evidence for Sasquatches. These are the best prints I've seen in my life.
Wow! I know for a fact they've got the evidence. It's going to come out soon.
You're hearing me alone in the studio, but just feet away from me in the world's Boston newsroom, let's just say it is a wild place. You can get a sneak peek behind the curtains via our Instagram feed. Follow us at PRI The World. Beware, some of us are pretty good at that World Cup arm-folding thing. Again, we're at PRI The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If an ancient Egyptian statue popped up on Antiques Roadshow, you can be sure appraisers would sit up and take notice. It just so happens that a 4,000-year-old statue of an Egyptian holy man is about to go on sale at Christie's Auction House in London. The statue is owned, legally at least, by the town of Northampton in England. It was first brought to England in the mid-19th century by a local dignitary known as the Second Marquess of Northampton. Now, the town's decided to auction off the statue. It's hoping to fetch a cool $10 million, which would bankroll the construction of a new wing in a local museum. But there is a hitch.
We believe that this sale is abuse of the values of the Egyptian archaeology and cultural property.
That's Ashraf El-Khoury, Egypt's ambassador to Britain.
It is so important. It's from the Old Kingdom. It is more than 3,500 years ago. Very good condition. Every single scholar, he need to see this statue in public. It have not to be hidden in private collection. And we consider this belong to Egypt heritage and it belonged to the whole humanity.
Local officials in Northampton, though, say they notified the Egyptian government of the sale 2 years ago. What's more, they say Egypt agreed to forfeit its right to recover any antiquities that were taken out of the country before 1970. But Ambassador El-Khoury says Egypt will not let this particular statue get away. El-Khoury asks this question, too. How exactly did the Second Marquess of Northampton manage to get the statue out of Egypt in the first place? And how much, if anything, did he pay for it back in the 1850s? This next item is going to sound so very public radio, but it seems a work of music about climate change debuted at number one on the Billboard Classical Album chart. It's serious business, though, when a classical composition gets its world premiere at Carnegie Hall. The CD is called The Drop That Contained the Sea. It's the second album for composer Christopher Tin, whose first effort snagged 2 Grammys. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
When I first heard about a classical album devoted to a droplet of water transforming from snow to a mountain stream to the ocean and back to the clouds, performed in 10 languages, I thought, interesting, but that's a bit much. Then I heard the music.
So the big epic finale of the album is a 12-minute piece called Waloyo Yamoni, which means We Overcome the Wind in Lango. And Lango is an East African dialect.
That's Los Angeles-based composer Christopher Tin. I asked him how he came up with the idea for a water-themed classical album and how he composes. He says sometimes he does it at a keyboard, sometimes at a computer.
And actually, a very large proportion of it is just me going on very long walks with my dog, muttering to myself, just kind of singing silently to myself. If you happen to bump into me on the streets of Santa Monica and I look like I'm schizophrenic, it's actually, I'm deep in thought and I'm composing.
Those dog walks didn't just produce 2 albums. Tin also scores films, and he won one of his Grammys for a song he wrote originally for a video game, the first and only person to claim that distinction. So why now turn to water?
Well, essentially, in the coming century, water and water management is going to be the most important global issue to all people across all countries, between melting Antarctic ice sheets and rising ocean levels and droughts and increased devastation from hurricanes and so forth. Water is literally going to shape the way that we draw our maps.
Still, listening to the music, I wasn't thinking of a cataclysm. I was imagining Disney cartoon lions bounding across the open savanna, not in a bad way. It's not too surprising. Tin counts Disney soundtracks among his influences, and he interned for the guy who composed the music for The Lion King. He says he writes dramatic because, well, he's dramatic. And so is classical music.
It takes you on a journey like no other form of music can. I don't personally believe in being coy with my emotions. I would rather just lay it all out there and just go for it. I mean, maybe I do have a bit of a flair for the dramatic, but
Tin's path to classical began in Northern California in the 80s and 90s, listening to rock.
So my three Desert Island cassette tapes, little Christopher Tin would have picked Pink Floyd's The Wall, The Beatles' Abbey Road, and The Who's Tommy.
Tin says he gravitated toward classical, drawn in by the mathematics, complexity, and architecture of the music. For his new Water album, Tin recruited musicians from across the globe.
Boy, in recording this album, I went everywhere. I went to Johannesburg, Dubai, Istanbul, Beijing, Sofia, London 3 times. I went everywhere.
The songs are sung in Turkish, ancient Greek, Mongolian, and here's a Viking tale about a hurricane sung in Old Norse.
Much in the way that a hurricane starts as a small swirl of winds and moisture and darkening clouds, I just wanted something that started off ominously and sort of built with just this feverish, powerful presence until it exploded just the way a hurricane does.
Tin says it doesn't matter if people don't understand Old Norse or Lango or Bulgarian. He says he wants people to enjoy his music. And if they get the message behind it, that's even better. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
The drop that contained the sea from composer Christopher Tin there. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.